Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. One of the places that is very much, it seems to me, of great and growing concern when it comes to protecting the country we love is the cauldron of conflict that has historically been the case with the Middle East. This is a place that enmities abound and unfortunately persist, it seems, indefinitely. And as a result, even when there seems to be a relative lull in physical violence, it's always around the corner at the very best, and in some cases going on under our noses, unattended to. A man who has studied this region closely and been enormously influential in his analyses and commentaries over decades, notably as a senior member in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, is our first guest. His name is Dr. Harold Rode. He is these days a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute and the author with us, among other works, at the Center for Security Policy Press, of an important book, Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. We're always glad to catch up with him, as it happens at the moment in Jerusalem. Dr. Rode, it's good to have you with us, sir. Welcome back.
Nice to be here, Frank. Always nice to be here. You do marvelous work.
Thank you. As do you. Let me ask you about one of these enmities that is of particular concern. I know to the people of Israel especially, but it should be to us as well. And that is the enmity that the Ayatollahs of Iran have expressed interminably since they came to power a little over 40 years ago. Death to Israel, death to America are their mantras. They mean it, by all evidence, and they are beavering away, as they have been for decades now, on acquiring advanced means of achieving such deaths on mass scales with high efficiency using nuclear weapons. I wanted to ask you, Harold, and whenever we touch base, it's usually this is front and center. The Biden administration, despite all of that, or arguably because of all of that, is desperately trying to get the Iranians to ink some kind of new understanding, new deal. A joint comprehensive plan of action is what they called it under the Obama administration. Trump withdrew from it. They want to reconstitute it in some form or fashion. First of all, if you can, tell us where you think this all stands, as well as whether it's likely to have any material benefit in terms of keeping the nuclear weapon out of the Iranian mullah's hands.
Well, we in the West, especially in the United States, the State Department, we love signed agreements. And they're everything. In the part of the world where I am right now, they mean zero, or maybe less than that if possible. Just to give you an example, we're all concerned about Russia and Ukraine. In 1994, we, the British and the Russians, signed an agreement that if the Ukrainians give up their nuclear weapons, then...
Which they had inherited from the Soviet Union.
Yeah, Soviet. Just as Russia inherited, if you wish, from the Soviet Union, then we will guarantee the borders of Ukraine. And we were so happy with this agreement and all that. And we saw what happens. We didn't do really we did nothing, basically, when Russia took Crimea and whatever. These are empty words. Now, in the Middle East, the agreements are worth even less than that. The way Middle Eastern, they make agreements in a very different way. And it is, as long as you're powerful, Frank, I will bow down to you. And the moment that I perceive you're weak, boom, I'm going to hit. And what the Iranians have done vis-a-vis the Americans during these entire, it isn't negotiations, it's capitulation agreements, is watched and laughed at us galore. And it, you need two things. You need, if you are a superpower, you need the ability to enforce your will and the will to enforce your will. And we may have the best weapons in the world, and I have little doubt of that, but we have no will, especially under the present administration, to enforce it. Now, it gets worse. The real people, for us, the Shiites and Sunnis, they, and their internal battles, we don't really care about it. Ah, what the hell? It's all, they're all the same. Well, as the Lebanese make a joke about everything, and they call the sushi, Su for Sunni and Shi for Shiite, ah, sushi. Well, the problem is that they're no bygones be bygones. And in fact, that's what you said in the beginning. The result of that is that the fight between the Shiites and the Sunnis at who should run is stand at the head of Islam, which has been going on since their prophet Muhammad died in 631, or at least we believe that. And so it's an internal battle. Now, if the Iranians either are believed to have or do have a nuclear weapon, then that is the way they're going to win. And we don't care, but they do. No, and if the Americans are, if you'll excuse me, dumb enough, I want to say ignorant enough, not to recognize what is going on, and they bow down to the Iranians, and we know the amount of people that the Iranian government kills in Iran every year for political reasons is one of the highest in the world. And when the enemy of Iran, the leader, if you wish, the cultural leader of the Sunni world, the Saudis, whatever happened with Khashoggi, and we have no smoking gun that he authorized the death of this fanatic anti-Western journalist.
That's Mohammed bin Salman you're talking about.
We have
Crown
no
Prince of Saudi Arabia.
There's no smoking gun. But we were wanted to call him a pariah and all sorts of things. But the Iranians, it doesn't matter what. Now, the question then becomes is why? Why is America doing this? And now we come to pure speculation and analysis. I can only say that if this administration is the continuation of the Obama administration and all of the people working on these type of issues are the same people, well, we don't know what Obama really thought, but we know that he wrote this book, Dreams from My Father. He didn't know his father. And so he couldn't have known what his father's dreams were. But that book he wrote was vicious against America and against and there are four heroes in this book: North Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, and Iran. So now I ask myself, is this the reason that the Biden people are kowtowing or giving in or in the Middle East, shall we say, playing the passive partner in a physical relationship? That's how the Middle Easterners understand this.
Well, and so tragic, as you know very well, Harold, that's implicit in everything you've just said. The more ignominiously we behave, the more we are empowering this enemy and giving it confidence that it can have its way with us with impunity. And
yes,
no good can come of that, not for us, not for our Israeli friends, Saudis, or others in the region as well. Harold, we have to take a very short break. When we come back, I want to pivot to another of these catastrophes brought to us again by the same people who ran policy for the Obama team, namely the Palestinian Authority and inflaming its ambitions and its conviction that it too can behave very badly against Israel and, for that matter, against us. That and more with the great Dr. Harold Rode right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
Joe Biden just extracted from taxpayers a campaign contribution for Democrats running for office this fall. It comes in the form of cancellations in whole or in part of some Americans' student loan debt and is expected to cost over $300 billion. Speaker Nancy Pelosi says only Congress can do that, and courts presumably will have their say. But the economic damage will have already been done. So will the harm to our society? Millions of us who either took out such loans for expensive college educations and paid them back, or simply did not attend college, will be footing the bill in a classic Marxist involuntary redistribution of wealth. Free stuff from government for favored groups, especially at election time, is hardly unprecedented, but this gambit's inherent unfairness and financial burdens on others will feed animosities and further undermine our nation. This is Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Harold Rode is still with us. We're talking about the Middle East, a part of the world that I think we're probably, once again, not giving sufficient attention to. There are things fermenting there that could be very much attention-grabbing in the not-too-distant future. One of them we've been discussing is the prospect that despite this, well, appalling conduct of the Biden team with respect to Iran, the Iranians are, if not now, very soon will be equipped with nuclear weapons with which to bring about death to Israel, death to the United States. Harold, I wanted to pivot to another aspect of the policies of this administration that I think are also very, very problematic, again, for Israel, but I believe also for us as well. And that is you're in Jerusalem, probably within a stone's throw of Palestinians who seek the destruction of the state of Israel. Those are not just folks associated with Hamas. They're also associated with the Palestinian Authority. And yet this administration conducts itself as though there are partners for peace still in the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas among them. And that if only we, you know, give them more money. I think there's some $500 million that has recently been freed up, sent their way. We talked about this with Itamar Marcus the other day, that money is, among other things, helping enable the sort of jihadism the Palestinians favor, as do Sharia supremacist Muslims elsewhere, of course, including Iran. But talk us through what's going on as you see it on the ground with respect to the Palestinians now and its implications.
Well, when America chooses people, allies, I would say the Palestinian Authority here, and in an odd way, even indirectly Hamas, even though we supposedly have them on the terrorist list, what we are signaling to everybody else, including Israel, is that we're weak, we won't stand with our allies, you cannot trust the United States. Believe me, this is not just in the Middle East that they think that, but if let's put it this way, if the Palestinian Authority wanted to make peace, then, you know, if it was genuine about it, then of course there could be a solution here. But the relationship between the Palestinians and Israel is not America and Canada. And the Palestinian Authority, if you read its textbooks, if you listen to its TV and radio, is viciously anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. And it uses, besides the word Israel, which is the Arabic word for Israel, it uses very often Yahudi or Yahud, which means Jew or Jews. And their goal was from the river to the sea, from the, they actually in the Arabic, if you watch what goes on the in Arabic, from the water to the water, meaning the River Jordan to the Mediterranean Sea, is ours. Now, there is no Israel, there's no U.S.-Canada relationship here. And what America is doing by helping the Palestinian Authority, which is oppressing the Palestinians as well, and we are behind that oppression. is basically undermining Israel, undermining our Saudi Arabian and Gulf allies who hate the Palestinians in ways that we just cannot understand the vicious hatred. Israelis don't hate Palestinians, but the Arab Sunnis all over basically wish that Israel would destroy them. I mean that.
So this is not, of course, what they say publicly, and they're especially when the United States encourages them, as we're doing now. They profess this deep-seated commitment to the Palestinians and their cause, but you're saying that ain't so. And Harold, one other thing that I just wanted to say that Idamar pointed out to us was the Palestinians are not too opaque, shall we say, about their hostility towards the United States as well. I mean, it's not just Israel. It's not just the Saudis. It's us too, even though we are now, under this administration, once again, propping them up and, as you say, empowering their oppression of their own people. So, Harold, can any good come of these sort of policies? We saw really some very important breakthroughs accomplished when essentially Donald Trump said, forget about it. We're not going to worry about the Palestinians. We're going to worry about these other relationships, notably what gave rise to these Abraham Accords. Having essentially repudiated all of that, more or less, and now gone back to failed policies, what's the upshot likely to be, do you think?
Well, it's simply sad. We are endangering all of those who in the end want a good relationship with us. And they look at us as an unreliable ally. Now, let me just say one thing. We in the United States look for common ground. We look for, you and I are negotiating. I'll give a little, you'll give a little. We have a bad relationship in the past. We shake hands, we're brothers, and we march on. The late, great Professor Bernard Lewis used to describe the way we do things as the State Department, someone from the State Department is talking with a counterpart at some cocktail party, and the local Arab or the local whatever, Turk or Iranian, are passionately saying, America did this awful thing and that awful thing. And the State Department person, instead of saying, trying to put the guy in his place, which is the only thing they respect, which is power, says, oh, the State Department guy says, what did we do wrong? What can we do to put it right?
Or simply agrees that America has done all kinds of horrible things. This is certainly all too common in this administration.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Harold, again, the point being that if you engage with people who really have this tradition of both honor and shame and respect for power and contempt for weakness, or worst of all, powerful people who behave without resolution or, in fact, weakly. This is a formula for greatly emboldening, it would seem to me, every enemy we've got, as you say, not just in the Middle East, but beyond as well. Height of irresponsibility, especially given the hard experiences that we've had in the past with all of this. Let me quickly ask you about one other thing. It's an insight into the region. You've written in Israel Hamon about the recent secret visit of an Israeli journalist to Mecca and the considerable upset that has caused the Saudis, because that city is supposed to be closed to non-Muslims. Just a quick appreciation of what that is entailing now and what might flow from it.
Well, you may be able to feel good about yourself and, oh my God, look what I did, as the videos that he put on the net from him being in Vec. Look at me, I'm special. I'm in all these places. Well, when the Muslims feel aggrieved, what's the word? Aggrieved. They will sit. They have enormous patience, and they will wait for the opportunity to get revenge. And what I had
I wrote back then the article
when this Israeli journalist was, I think, kind of stupid, and I completely unaware of what the consequences of this could be for him in the long run. A week or two later, a guy, Rushdie thinks it's 33 years since this fatwa issued this.
Watch your back, is I guess the bottom line. Harold, we're out of time. We're going to have to come back to you on this as well as these other very important topics. Thank you, my friend. Your insights into the Middle East are incredibly important. We appreciate the chance to share them with our audience. God bless you. Stay well. Next up, Peter Husey on nuclear war fighting. Is that in the cards? Right ahead.
Night after night in cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back, and it's always a pleasure to say we're joined by Peter Husey. He is a guy who thinks seriously about things that the rest of us tend not to think about, including nuclear war fighting, and whether, as we've been told endlessly for decades, including, it seems to me, by people who don't believe it, that nuclear wars cannot be fought and won. And we wanted to explore that with him. Peter is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute these days, specializing in nuclear deterrence issues, arms control, and the like. He's also the president of Geostrategic Analysis. He is a Washington insider of the First Order, as a host, among other things, of a series of very informative meetings, breakfasts, dinners, lunches, what have you, that bring people together to think and talk about the sorts of challenging topics that we're addressing with him today. Peter Husey, it's always good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you, Frank. It's always a pleasure to meet with you.
I want to talk first and foremost about this idea, and it's not so much whether American presidents or, for that matter, the American people think nuclear wars can be fought or won, for that matter. Do our enemies believe that to be the case?
Well, Frank, that's the $64,000 question, and the answer is they actually believe that using nuclear weapons in a conflict, particularly in a failing conventional conflict, is not only doable, but is their strategy. They have said so in writing. They have exercised their forces in this way, and as my friend James Howe down in Huntsville has pointed out, they are building weapons that are very low yield, very highly accurate. And they believe a limited number of nuclear weapons can be used in a conflict early on to get the United States to stand down. And
these are particularly
escalate to win.
Yeah, what are known as tactical nuclear weapons that can be.
And they believe it. And that's the question is, we may think it's crazy. We may think it's totally wrong. Yeah. But the fact is, Mr. Putin has made it very clear, and Xi Jinping has made it very clear, that they would use nuclear weapons early in a conventional conflict, like in China's case, to keep Japan out. And so far, Putin's made 40 explicit threats against the United States about using nuclear weapons against us since he invaded Ukraine.
Yeah. And Peter, one of the things that you touched on there that I think is really central to answering this question is how the Russians, how the Chinese, and perhaps others, are posturing their forces and putting into place things like protection for leadership figures, and for that matter, other key parts of their population, missile defenses, air defenses, underground bunkers, including some vast ones, all of which suggests that the doctrine that you talked about is actually backed up by capabilities, and not just at the tactical level, perhaps, but also in terms of, you know, strategic nuclear war fighting as well. No?
Well, I agree with you. You have to understand it. In totalitarian nations since 1917 have killed 125 million of their own people to stay in power. How many people do you think they've killed if you add up all the wars of national liberation, Vietnam, Korea? It's in the multi-millions. And the question is, what are they willing to do to stay in power? How reckless will be? Well, you only can look, Frank, at what they build, what they say, and what they do.
Right. And especially what they do.
Okay. Yeah. What else do we have we can assume, as some of my colleagues do, that, oh, no, they're not that reckless and not that crazy and so forth. But at the same time, they advocate getting rid of nuclear weapons, including the U.S. getting rid of a lot of ours unilaterally, because they think it's so dangerous that at some point some mistake might be made and we'd end up in Armageddon. I share their concerns. But my concern is with the guys over in Peking and Moscow and Pyongyang and Tehran, they're the crazy folks, not us.
And a unilaterally disarmed United States is an invitation to craziness, perhaps, on their part rather than a deterrent to it. Which brings me, Peter, to a particular pet rock of many of these unilateral disarmers, and that is the idea that we've got to get rid of the land-based long-range missile forces, what are known as intercontinental range ballistic missiles, or ICBMs. You have spent decades both studying and discussing the important contribution that those particular weapons make to deterrence. Give us just a very short course on why unilaterally dismantling the 450 of our Minuteman intercontinental range ballistic missiles is inadvisable, especially against the backdrop of what we just discussed.
Let me start with back in the 1970s when it was a real concern of General James Schlesinger, who was Secretary of Defense and candidate then Ronald Reagan, that the Russians with their 10,000 plus warheads could take out most of our land-based missiles, which are the most accurate systems, and basically sue for peace. And then we built the submarines to be more accurate, which helped. We got arms control under Reagan, which actually did help. And we modernized our entire nuclear deterrent. And we took down the Soviet
Empire. Which really helped.
Which was enormous. And missile defense was a big part of that. The same people that have argued that the Russians would be crazy to hit us with all those weapons because 20 to 30 million Americans would die. And no American president is going to sit around and not retaliate. So the Russians would know, you do this, you're going to get Armageddon coming back. These are the same people, exactly the same people that now argue that ICBMs are dangerous because the Russians, with not 10,000 warheads, but, you know, pick a number, around 2,000 in their entire arsenal that's deployed, would somehow attack us at this time. And it's ludicrous. But here gets it even dicier, is they claim that now the Russians are, that everything's on hair trigger, in a crisis they're going to go after us. Well, what's the impact? The impact is all our submarines and bombers come back at them. So it's no different in terms of our deterrent. If you get rid of ICBMs, all of a sudden you don't have 500 targets to hit. The Russians have a handful, and I mean 10. Three bomber bases, two sub bases, and you pick the number of submarines somewhere between 0 and 12 you think are at sea. As General Welch, who former chief of staff of the Air Force, said, if they could attrit those submarines at sea over time, we wouldn't know who did it. And then our other elements are soft targets, which could be taken out with not even with nuclear weapons. So we're basically inviting our adversaries to come and disarm us. in a first strike.
If we were to remove those many ICBM
right now, it's impossible for them to do it without a massive attack. Which, as I said, can you imagine being a colonel in the Russian strategic rocket forces, going to your general officer, say, "I got a great idea. We're going to hit America with 1,000 warheads tomorrow. Take out maybe 90% of their ICBMs. Wouldn't that be great?" The general officer would not only fire him, he'd probably lock him up.
Yeah. Well, look, the point is, Peter, that I think folks like you and, you know, us in this program, and also, of course, our late and much lamented friend, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, have been making this case for years, as I think have most in the U.S. military as well. Deterrence is something you don't want to try to do on the cheap if you want to deter people. I did want to just give you an opportunity to memorialize Peter, because he made such an outsized contribution in this area and electromagnetic pulse and so many others.
There are a lot of great analysts, but they're few with enormous courage. He was absolutely fearless about laying it out as it is. His work on EMP, historically, if we can fix our grid, as he has advocated, it'll be in his honor we do it. But he was a great friend, absolutely fearless. And I must say, without any guile or political thing, he just said it as it is. And he also had a wonderful wry sense of humor, which we will miss. Indeed. But I had him recently come and speak. I think it was in June. Mm-hmm. And he talked about a nuclear Pearl Harbor. And of course, he was. So we will miss him greatly, but I tell you what, we will be inspired by him.
We certainly are. In fact, we're calling our Secure the Grid coalition and the larger efforts to secure our most critical infrastructure, the PRI project at the Center for Security Policy.
That's wonderful, Frank.
In honor of a living legacy. Peter, let me ask you about one other thing. The conventional side of the House, though it has some bearing on deterrence, of course, more generally. The U.S. Navy has gone back and forth and back and forth and back and forth on the number of ships that it intends to have in the fleet. I guess they've got something approaching 300 at the moment, but they're talking about removing this year something on the order of 30 plus. And I understand that the idea is always, well, you're going to get rid of those so you have additional resources that you can use to buy new ones. But Peter, I fear that we're maybe at the cusp of war with China, and it seems to me this is a very bad time to be mothballing or taking out of service as many combatants as we are now talking about.
Let me give you some numbers. When President Reagan became president, the average age of an Air Force airplane was 12 years old. And we thought it was old then. We called it a hollow army, which is what its entire armed forces that he inherited. Today, the average age of an Air Force airplane is 28 years. And by the way, the Air Force is the smallest it's been in their history and the oldest. The Navy has a similar problem in that when you don't modernize and don't, you end up basically having to sustain and maintain very old systems. And then you have the irony of systems that aren't that old that you want to get rid of to save money, to put into our research and development for advanced technology that will yield you new forces in 2029, 2030.
That's a long time.
But as you and I said, the bad guys aren't going to wait around for us to get better.
Peter, we have to let it go at that for the moment, but we're going to come back to you and talk further about this force structure that is old and we're now taking it apart, it seems.
Yes.
The inadvisability of that should be obvious to everybody. Thank you for the work you do at the Hudson Institute. We'll look forward to our
conversation. Thank you, Frank. I appreciate it.
We'll be talking with Chuck DeVore of Texas about this sort of subject and more right after this. We'll be right back.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Joe Biden just extracted from taxpayers a campaign contribution for Democrats running for office this fall. It comes in the form of cancellations in whole or in part of some Americans' student loan debt and is expected to cost over $300 billion. Speaker Nancy Pelosi says only Congress can do that, and courts presumably will have their say. But the economic damage will have already been done. So will the harm to our society. Millions of us who either took out such loans for expensive college educations and paid them back, or simply did not attend college, will be footing the bill in a classic Marxist involuntary redistribution of wealth. Free stuff from government for favored groups, especially at election time, is hardly unprecedented, but this gambit's inherent unfairness and financial burdens on others will feed animosities and further undermine our nation. This is Frank Affney.
Back, and it's always a delight to say we have one of the smartest guys I know, one of the most accomplished I know, and one of the most patriotic I know in the House. His name is Chuck DeVore. He served in the United States Army, rose through the ranks to lieutenant colonel. He has been a member of the State Assembly of California. These days, he is the chief national initiatives officer, the Texas Public Policy Foundation. You've seen him on Tucker and other programs. We're always delighted to have him as a resource here at Securing America. Chuck DeVore, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Frank.
I have a lot of things I want to talk to you about, and I'm going to take advantage of the fact that you are a man of many parts, a Renaissance man, to pick your brains about several different things. I'd like to get, first and foremost, your thoughts about this student loan gambit that Joe Biden unveiled yesterday. As best I can tell, nobody has any idea how much this thing is going to cost. But what we do know is it's going to cost a lot of people who didn't, go to college, or maybe did and had student loans and paid them off, who are going to be picking up the tab for people who haven't paid their loans off yet and evidently won't, at least in full. What is actually going on here, as best you can tell? Is this purely a partisan electoral play?
Frank, it's exactly that. It's a partisan electoral play. They don't even know how much it's going to cost. I've seen low-end estimates of $300 billion. I've heard as much as $900 to $1 trillion, so $900 billion to a trillion. I think the bottom line is it's unconstitutional. It'll probably get overturned, but that doesn't matter. What matters is that the core constituency now for the modern Democratic Party are college-educated Americans, and kind of ironically, white non-Hispanic college-educated Americans. And so what this is going to do is it's going to penalize by shifting the burden from the individuals who took out loans to get a valuable degree, to they're consuming valuable goods, right? They're getting a college education that means that they're part of America's elite. And so we're going to shift the burden of paying that to the general treasury, meaning that the majority of American taxpayers who don't have college degrees are going to be responsible for paying this back. And of course, the colleges are going to raise tuition, just like we saw with the automobile manufacturers raising the price of electric vehicles as soon as the Inflation Reduction Act went through and codified an increase in the subsidies for electric vehicles. So, again, I believe it's unconstitutional. And see, Frank, that's part of the intrigue of it, right? So as soon as someone files suit to stop it, even more so politically, the Democrats are going to say, look, see, those mean Republicans are stopping you from having this tuition
free stuff.
Relief. Right, exactly. And the plot thickens, Frank. The whole don't pay your loans, don't pay on your student loans, this freeze because of COVID, that's going to be extended until when, Frank? December, just weeks after the midterm elections.
That election. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And here's the further irony, right? Is that COVID is over for the border. Title 42, right? We have no COVID for the border. But we still have COVID for college loans.
Yeah, of course. Let me understand how this would work going forward. Will people not have to pay $10,000 worth of student loans, or is that to be determined? I don't get how this is going to actually play out.
It seems to me that it only applies to the existing loans right now. Of course, there's an element of moral hazard in this, right? Is that as soon as you do it, you send the signal that this is going to continue to happen on in through the future. And so students are going to do what? Prospective students are going to borrow even more money, maybe pursue a degree that's more aspirational, maybe something of greater interest to them, maybe something less difficult, something that's economically less likely to provide a return on your investment. So we'll probably have a lot more worthless left-wing degrees that don't actually contribute to the economy and more debt. And, you know, we'll figure that out later.
I got to tell you, this sounds like a very bad public policy. And since that's an area you specialize in, I'm very glad to get your calibration on it.
It's really good politics, though.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? At the end of the day, it's all about politics. So is, I think, this election, electric vehicle business that you mentioned was part and parcel of the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. Another of these things where, as you say, Chuck, they've simply said, well, a lot of people who aren't ever going to own an electric vehicle are going to have to subsidize the few who will. This seems to be, well, Marxist in terms of a redistribution of wealth involuntarily to the American people. But also there's a, I don't know, I've come up with a sort of idea that this climate change stuff is jihadism, in the sense that there's a sort of religious fetish quality to it. On the one hand, it's suicidal for our societies if we go down this road. Look at some of the places like Sri Lanka and the Netherlands and Canada now that are, you know, I think succumbing in really material ways. Diminishing the quality of life and their economic well-being and their societies for that matter.
Right.
And then on top of all of that, you have this sort of quality of submission. Everybody must submit to the agenda. So where are we going with this program, do you think? Is it
right? Right. Well, I mean, this is one of the reasons why you often see the people who promote this climate catastrophicism, this whole existential existence and crisis theme, you often see them expressing open contempt or concern about democratic processes or representative government, right? Because they know, if you look at the opinion polls, overwhelmingly people are in favor of green energy, you know, wind and solar power and all this stuff, except when you ask the question and you say, well, would you be willing to go green if it meant $20 a month more in your electric bill? Just $20, Frank.
Right.
And what ends up happening is support goes from 80% and it collapses to 20%.
Yeah.
Because
and
once
you can't
people
have the rest of that stuff without that kind of subsidizing. Cool. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. And so
you don't even get to the point of we're having to import the materials for it from China. We're going to talk about all of this and more on the other side of a very short break. We're going to continue with Chuck DeVore of the Texas Public Policy Foundation, Lieutenant Colonel, United States Army, retired. We'll be right back with Chuck on a whole host of other issues as well, right after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Chuck DeVore is in the house. I'm always happy to be able to say that virtually in this case. We're joined by him from Texas, where he is with the Texas Public Policy Foundation as its chief national initiatives officer. And Chuck, we were talking a little bit about this craziness of forcing people who aren't really going to benefit from certain things that the state is prioritizing for a favored few to pay for it. And this is, as you say, something that generally sticks in people's craws when they're apprised of how this is going to work out for them. It brings me to a couple of other topics. Also in that Inflation Reduction Act was a mandate, an authorization for 87,000 new IRS agents, doubling effectively the size of that operation. Can any good come of that, as far as you can tell?
Yeah, so this goes back to really quite dismal math, right? That the more revenue officers that you hire, the more revenue that you can raise. I mean, I saw this when I was vice chair of Revenue and Taxation Committee in the State Assembly in California, right? The same thing, because California has an income tax. So if we hire more revenue agents, we can raise more revenue. Now, the practical matter is, Frank, that there are not a lot of billionaires out there, and there's not a lot of centimillionaires. And generally speaking, they have pretty good accountants, and they have pretty good tax attorneys, and they have their stuff together. And they're not particularly fearful of audits, because for them, it's just a minor inconvenience. But if you're like a small business owner, or let's say even better yet, an immigrant to America, that perhaps English isn't your first language, and the Byzantine IRS tax code is something that's even more difficult than learning English. And so that individual is going to be at high risk. This individual who's trying to realize the American dream, and you know, maybe they by mistake didn't pay some fine, or they didn't quite get their payroll taxes right. Now, obviously, everybody needs to pay what they owe the federal government. However, and here's the big thing: when you've got a significant increase in the number of auditors, because Frank, when you talk about doubling the IRS, what we're really talking about is increasing the number of auditors by several factors. It's more than double, right? Because a lot of the current employees are not auditors. So this is going to be a lot more auditors. This is probably going to triple or quadruple your chances of an audit, maybe even quintuple. And so what ends up happening is they come and with tax law, you are guilty until you prove yourself innocent. So if they look at your numbers, they're going to say, no, you owe us $500,000. Show us that you don't. And then you have to spend all this money and time, all this grief, all this stress to try to show the IRS that you've actually paid enough money. And what ends up happening is a lot of people will just pay some settlement because they can't take it. They just can't stand the time waste and the stress. And so these officers are going to be primarily focused on middle-class Americans, on the working poor, people who take the earned income tax credit, for example, and on small business owners. This isn't going to affect the billionaires like the Democrats said.
It's like Willie Sutton said about the money, you know, this is where the money is, the money that will be most easily wrenched from the American people, at least.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, it's no surprise, I guess, that some of these congressional, agencies, as well as independent analysts have said, you know, you're going to find people earning well under, $200,000,
right,
making up the bulk of the audits. And,
that's right. And so, Frank, let me tie together this really painful irony, right? You had the student loan forgiveness, which is unconstitutional, and I think will be overturned. Let's say that it goes through. $900 billion going to people with college degrees who are already the elite. Then you hire 87,000 IRS agents who are going to do what? They're going to go collect taxes almost exclusively on people who don't have college degrees. What a country.
Yeah, well, it's going to be less of a country that we're familiar with and love if all of this eventuates. Chuck, I want to pivot to another issue. You talked about it recently with Tucker Carlson. It's so important to election integrity. Talk about this mail-in balloting problem and the fraud that's associated with it.
Yeah, Frank, this is a really troubling thing because we know that the unions, the Postal Service unions, are pretty active in politics. They've always endorsed Democrats. And there's a lot of evidence, including from Postal Service audits, that election mail arrives late and it's affected elections. I've seen it even here in Texas where someone running where I live, 10,000 plus pieces arrive after Election Day. Now, those are just campaign mailers. What about mail-in ballots? We're actually talking about people's ballots. And so we see that the post office has created this new division, supposedly focused on nothing but mail-in ballots. Frank, the problem with mail-in ballots is there's no ID. You have people that help people fill in the ballot, so the secrecy of the ballot gets trashed. And we know that many, many places across America, there's precincts that are overwhelmingly Democrat and overwhelmingly Republican. So I can only imagine that if you're the Postal Service Union, you're going to maybe slow walk those overwhelmingly Republican mail-in ballots. And, you know, if they show up after the election, oh, well, no one will ever get punished.
Yeah. And there are additional problems, of course, associated with the lack of identification and, you know, drop boxes and...
Exactly.
And again, Chuck, what's so important about this is that we're all on notice about this. A bipartisan commission co-chaired by Jim Baker of Texas and Jimmy Carter, a former Democratic president, were very clear that mail-in ballots are a formula for fraud. And
yes.
Shame on us, shame particularly on their proponents, whether they're using the cover of the COVID pandemic or some other pretext, it is rife with problems. And I so appreciate your voice being powerfully amplified by Tucker Carlson saying, don't go there. Chuck, we're going to be talking about all of this and more with you in the days to come. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
And your great service to our country. I know you'll keep it up at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. Thanks to the rest of you for joining us for this edition of Securing America. I hope you feel better equipped to help us in protecting the country we love, and that you will henceforth go forth and multiply.